This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Now, here's Frank Morano.
A Malaysia Airlines flight with 239 people on board, including four Americans, has gone missing. At this hour, a desperate search is underway for MH Flight 370.
A colossal, mysterious dark void has emerged on the sun's surface, emitting powerful bursts of swift radiation called solar wind straight towards Earth. This extraordinary occurrence, characterized by a gap wider than 60 Earths, is unprecedented in the solar cycle phase.
Of all the missions mounted to the moon, there's only been a 40% success rate. We believe we can do better than that. I put our odds at 75% success.
The lander's not designed to survive a lunar night, and that's true. But, you know, we all have our fingers crossed. And when we got the news this morning that it had actually survived and woken up autonomously and started communicating and responding to signals, then, you know, that was a really good way to start a Monday morning.
Side of Midnight presents From the Spiral to the Elliptical to the Lenticular to the Irregular to the Quasars Galaxies. Where are we in the cosmic evolutionary picture? Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. The following conversations are Cosmic Conversations with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky.
That's right. If it involves the sky, our man is Dr. Sky. Steve Cates, a veteran radio and TV infotainer, a man who has seemingly all the answers. Even if he doesn't have the answers, he sounds good explaining why he doesn't know the answer. He is one of our favorite guests. We talk to him on a bi-weekly basis, and he does his own terrific podcast called The Dr. Sky Experience, which you can check out by going to redapplepodcastnetwork.com. Steve, I can't believe it's been 2 weeks already, but what a 2 weeks it's been.
Absolutely, Frank. Good morning to you and the listeners. Excited to get into our cosmic conversations. And obviously much to talk about in this very short hour as we go light speed.
Indeed. Let me begin with Flight 370. This week is the 10th anniversary of the disappearance of this plane that was operated by Malaysia Airlines that just pretty much disappeared while flying from Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia to its planned destination in China. And this story is a lot more interesting than just the 239 souls that perished, although that in and of itself is pretty significant. This story is interesting because other than maybe Amelia Earhart, this is one of the most significant aviation mysteries in history. There's been a lot of theories about what caused the disappearance of this plane. I've heard everything from pilot suicide to fire in the cockpit to a Russian missile to supernatural explanations. What do you make of this, Steve? What's your analysis of what became of Flight 370?
Well, Frank, I've done my own investigation on my other shows that we've talked about here before, you know, doing this here on your great station and great network. But this obvious aircraft, just so we put it in perspective, was a Boeing 777-200ER, meaning it was a second iteration of Boeing's great and successful 777 with the ER on it, meaning extended range aircraft. So their original flight plan was to fly there as they moved away, you know, from the Kuala Lumpur area and then fly over to China. But as they got 39 minutes into the flight, as many people may not know, Ho Chi Minh, of course, their air traffic control center, said basically goodnight to them as they were flying onto their original destination in China. Nothing was heard from them after that. So generally, this is kind of the quick take on this. It appears from talking to so many people over the time period here, over these 10 years, there's no absolute answer to this, but you're asking me personally, so here we go. I think it was a suicide by the captain of the aircraft, Captain Shaw. An intentional way to bring this airplane down, it's pretty simple. We know that if you fly commercially since 9/11, the cockpit doors are very well secured. So he could have enticed the other person in the cockpit or anybody else who was there legally to fly, part of the flight crew, to, let's say, give him a few minutes, you know, give them a few minute break to go stretch, get a cup of coffee or whatever, and lock the door. Now, that sounds a little ludicrous, but it could happen. Because knowing a lot of people in the law enforcement world, those doors are pretty much, you know, unbreachable. I mean, you could literally take a rifle like an AK-47 and try to shoot through that thing, and it's armored up pretty good. So the point is, what then happened to the aircraft? What happened to the passengers on board? Many people believe that the captain intentionally depressurized the cabin, thus everybody had a very quick, well, maybe not quick, but a very slow lapse into unconsciousness. And then that airplane continued to fly on, as many people think, well into the south portion of the Indian Ocean, in an area where obviously there's no land. And how long could that aircraft fly, even if it's an ER version, an extended range? But as you mentioned correctly, 239 souls perished, potentially the transponder turned off. Now, the search for that aircraft was over 46,000 square miles. And apparently, nothing was ever found from their deep sonar that they have in these ships to per, you know, look at what's down in the bottom of the ocean. Because you're talking about depths of 2.5 miles there. But strange, Frank, this is interesting. Strangely, a wing section, allegedly, or a piece of a wing, was found in 2015 on Reunion Island. And allegedly, some pieces washed up. How did they know it was from that aircraft? Parts on there match serial numbers and such from the original build sheets on that. So that's basically what I think happened there. But Frank, this is also very strange. Take that same identical aircraft, the Boeing 777-200ER, and move through time and space in that same year, 131 days later, and we find out another disastrous episode happened, not to change subjects on you. But MH17, another of the same Malaysian aircraft, the same aircraft type, the same 200ER version, is then shot down somewhere over the far right side of the Ukraine, allegedly by, what, a Russian missile
right,
coming down like a SAM missile. But the point is, that's the most amazing thing, as you mentioned before, apropos, like the Amelia Earhart situation. And that's such a sad thing because that aircraft, you know, a very reliable airplane and one that, of course, is very powerful in the air. It's powered by, I don't know the iteration on that aircraft, but it's either GE engines, Pratt & Whitney's, or Trent 800s. And they have incredible thrust, like 77,000 and 98,000 pounds of thrust. And if you've not stood in front of a 777, the engine cowling alone on that aircraft is as wide as a 737 aircraft. So my point is that aircraft can carry a big load, and it can carry a big load of passengers. But it's so tragic and so sad. Maybe somewhere there's another answer to that, but that's mine and a little longer than I wanted to take on it.
No. I appreciate the thorough manner in which you answered that, as you always sure. come through. By the way, if people have questions about this or anything else we delve into this hour, or questions involving aviation, space, the moon, the stars, or anything else that you're curious about, you can give us a call at 1-800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. And we'll be happy to take your call throughout the hour. Steve, just going back to the 370 situation for a second,
sure.
Two-part question based on your theory, and obviously none of us know, but what makes you think it was a pilot suicide? Is there any other evidence beyond the sudden disappearance from radar of the plane that leads you to think this? And two, even if it was a suicide, why would it be so difficult to find wreckage or any sort of remains from the airplane? I know you mentioned that one aspect that was found, but really, again, I don't know a lot about this stuff, but I would think that there would be more found here, especially with so many entities searching for any sort of remnants of this airplane. Why do you think it was a suicide, and why have we seen so little of this plane?
Sure, let's take the first part of your question, the suicide. There's many rumors out there, and the people in the aviation world, I think, know so much more about this. But I've read and talked to some people in the aviation industry, said that this Captain Shaw, was a big participant in his own home of following up with Flight Simulator. In other words, many pilots, they go to flight training, of course. They get their certifications. They have to go back. I've sat and flown in some of those full-motion simulators. And that's a whole other story. I mean, it kind of made me nauseous. But here's a guy that did this extra at his home. So he had a lot of skill set, maybe well beyond that of some of the other pilots. But the answer to part two of what your question is, and my theory is this, we don't know. If an aircraft were to come down in the ocean and do like a belly flop into the water, that may give us a little less chance of finding more parts, it would find more parts, because the thing would sink to the bottom and then maybe break apart. But the theory there goes, maybe this was a nosedive into the ocean, and at great speeds. You know, these aircraft are flying at flight altitude, let's say 35, 40,000 feet, well over 500 miles per hour, and that's probably a slim thing, because now aircraft, we're finding out, get pushed by the jet stream, and allegedly their speed is over the, you know, faster than the speed of sound, but that's not an accurate statement. But with extra wind, my point is simply this, part two of your question. It could have been simply a straight nosedive in which the entire aircraft shatters into more pieces. It's not able to survive. If you look at ground crashes of certain aircraft that have hit ground and have come straight down, horrible as that is, there was one in the area of Colorado Springs, and I'm not sure what airline it was. It was a 737. It went down, straight down, and God forbid, it was the most horrible scene. Imagine the first responders there. You're not finding much of anything, aircraft parts or anything, or take Flight 93, of course, from the 9/11 tragedy, the one, of course, that we're talking about in Pennsylvania. That alleged went straight down, almost like a 90-degree angle. So that's possibly what happened there.
Interesting.
Part two of your question.
All right, 800-848-9222. We will get to your questions, as many of your questions this hour as we can. But, Steve, the last time we spoke 2 weeks ago, we were both brimming with optimism over Odysseus. It was going to be the first attempt to go back to the moon by an American-made craft in over 50 years. There was a lot of talk about what this meant for lunar exploration, a lot of talk about what this meant for the American space program, a lot of talk about what it meant for scientific research in general, and jumpstarting the private sector space race even more. It doesn't seem, while we did get some images back, there was an incident where this this lunar rover landed on its side and it ran out of power or something along those lines. In layman's terms, Steve, explain to us what happened with Odysseus, and was this, objectively, was this mission a success or not?
Well, I think overall, to get to the moon in that part of the region of the moon near the South Pole is a great success story. But Intuitive Machines, I think, had designed a fairly reliable machine. But it goes back to the geometry. And I know John Katsimatidis and I were talking on his program on the Cats Roundtable. And he have obviously agreed, and I agree with him, that if you're going to have a tall vehicle, meaning a tall spacecraft, it's like taking a refrigerator that's taller than your refrigerator in the house. It's taller than it is wide, let's say. But this goes on steroids. The landing pod for that is the legs are not spread out far enough that prevents the opportunity of it when it lands in a very rocky and unstable region like the South Pole of the moon. It obviously came down. They had some issues with the descent radar. They call it a LIDAR radar system. They had a backup. But the problem is, with that particular lander, it's now lying on its side. The Japanese slim lander had an even worse landing on the surface of the moon. It landed upside down. So I think overall, to answer your question, I think it's a success in that they get there. But the ROI on this, or the bang for the buck, what it was supposed to do, no. So I hope everybody, you know, in those engineering classes and the designers of this, they have a better ability. Just take a look at the lunar landers on the moon. It was a shorter, stubby kind of vehicle with a far wide spread of those four landing pods. But it did send back an image just a day or so ago, that is Odysseus. And this is interesting. It's kind of the Greek war victor of the Troy War, named after that individual in Greek history. But what's interesting about this, it, even though it's on its side, it sent back an interesting picture, because it's solar powered, before the lunar night begins, of a beautiful crescent Earth in the sky, and then the darkness of the moon comes. Remember, a day on the moon, Frank, is some 14 Earth days long, so the batteries are going to run out. Both this and the Japanese lander are probably finished right now. Overall, on a scale of 1 to 100, I'd say I'd give it an 80 or an 85, and some people think I'm overly generous.
All right. Okay. Well, that's not bad. Now, and if anybody doesn't know, and I've met some of your former students, and they have really great things to say about you. At one time, you were a high school teacher, so people should take your grading seriously.
That's a long time ago, and that's measured in thousands of days in the past, but no, that's a nice compliment from them. But the interesting thing, Frank, no, to be really serious here, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm attacking any of these companies. I mean, the big success here to me is, even though it's, you know, like a 80-85% success rate, it's done by private enterprise. And I think that's the point here. Look at Elon Musk. He's launched and will launch another big Starship rocket, a 400-foot-tall, most massive, powerful rocket on the Earth. And he's had two, quote, failures that they knew were predictive failures. So the point is, those folks that, you know, the company that manufactured Odysseus, you know, Intuitive Machines, they're calling it a general success. And, of course, they're kind of covering their bases, too. There needs to be a lot more research done into this about the difficulty of landing on the moon, particularly the South Pole. And once again, proudly, I'll say it, Frank, what the heck is the rush in many people's estimation? You hear this all over. Oh, we got to get people back to the moon by this date. Take your time and do it right. And that would obviously do what? First of all, save lives. Now, imagine this in closing on this. If you take a look at the Starship lander, it's 165 feet tall, made of stainless steel. It literally is like taking a pen and standing it straight up on end. The little landing legs on that are in probably a far worse situation. And guess what that thing has to do? Just like the Odysseus, it has to come down straight, land with its retro rocket, like the old sci-fi movies. Look how tall that is. And if you land on an angle, that baby is going to tip over and just, you know, collapse like you drop a tree in the forest. So let's take our time to do this. And I don't understand the rush, do you? I mean, to get people to the moon, we've
well,
done it.
I do understand the rush in that we want to show that America can still do things this. But, I mean, what's if you're rushing to get it wrong and screw it up, what are we really showing the world? Not very much. All right, a lot of people very eager to chat with you. We're going to get to as many calls as we can here. Let me begin with Dave in Pennsylvania. Hey, Dave.
Hey, hi, guys. One of the greatest aviation mysteries in history is something called Flight 19. Are either of you familiar with that at all?
No, sir. Please tell me. And I'm usually up on these things, but go right ahead. I'm interested to hear.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. There's a case of five fighter airplanes, Navy airplanes, that left the coast of Florida, flew into the Bermuda Triangle and disappeared. And there was communication with the Florida, you know, the tower. And then another plane flew out to rescue them, and that disappeared too. You ought to look into it. It would be quite
well, Dave, I do know about the airplanes, and thank you. I didn't know the flight number. But here's a little commentary on that. That is one of the most strange things ever to occur, too. We don't have any idea where those airplanes went. But here's a theory, too. If you look at the gravity of the Earth, there's an area off the right side of Brazil called the South Atlantic Anomaly. And what it is, very simple in Earth terms, it's an area of gravity instability because of some giant bulge in the Earth, you know, like inside the core. Now, would that make planes disappear? I don't know. But the point is, they're also saying that that's what the Bermuda, quote, triangle could be, some kind of gravity anomaly where all these airplanes crashed into the ocean. But the other theory, right, Frank, this goes into the conspiracy side, is that that was some sort of a massive abduction by some intelligent life from another world. But, Dave, thank you for bringing that
up. I'm going to look into that in a future show, 800-848-9222. Dr. Sky is here for the hour. We'll take your calls, and I have a lot more to cover because the United States isn't the only country that has an interest in the moon. We'll tell you who else is going there. We'll give you the tips that you need to know in order to see and enjoy the upcoming solar eclipse next month. And if you want to hear more from Dr. Sky, you can hear him on the Dr. Sky Experience. Just search that on any podcast app or go to redapplepodcastnetwork.com and search Dr. Sky. We'll continue straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Hi, it's Ernie Anastas. You know, your thoughts can affect how you feel, and how you feel can impact your thoughts. Addressing your mind and body connection is the key to improving your overall wellness. Bergen Newbridge Medical Center is the largest hospital in New Jersey, providing comprehensive, equitable, compassionate, and high-quality emergency inpatient and outpatient medical care, plus mental health services and substance use disorder treatment. The Bergen Newbridge team can address your total health needs in one convenient location. Call 201-225-7130. For an appointment or newbridgehealth.org.
Save big money and transform your home with new appliances now at Menards. We offer the lowest prices and the largest in-stock appliance selection ready to take home today. Check out top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. A upgrade your home and save big money on new appliances at Menards. Shop our entire selection of appliance options online today at Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
After the hour, we haven't had a man on the moon in quite some time, but there are craft going back to the moon, and it's not just the United States trying to go there. Our guest for the hour is Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. Steve, what is going on with Japan's attempts to go back to the moon and their lunar rover?
Well, what they're doing is, this is an earlier one that happened in February. Their lander called the Slim, as I was mentioning before, making a comparison between the U.S., you know, the Odysseus lander. This lander is also pretty sophisticated. And out of it, when it came down, obviously it landed on its upside down. How strange that is. But remember, everything on the moon is 1/6 the gravity of the Earth. So things can bounce around on the surface of the moon. Ask Alan Shepard, you know, in the past when he hit a golf ball off the surface of the moon. But this particular object, Frank, actually had two tiny little rovers that popped out of it, LEV-1 and LEV-2. And one of them, you know, it goes back to, you know, when I was younger, and a lot of my relatives had little toys by a Japanese company called Tomy. They made these little, like, robots. Well, they were the ones who made this little rover, so to speak. It actually was taking some images, and it has a little ham radio transmitter that's actually in there. So the ham radio community was all excited. You couldn't really talk to it. You could just listen to the signal. But unfortunately, that didn't work. But there's going to be more series of these coming up. They're going to get it right. And as I mentioned before, let's get it right before we send people back there. But the big question has to be answered for this question and answer. Why is it so difficult to land at the South Pole of the moon? And if you take a look at the geography down there, it's incredibly cratered. You know, this is an incredibly, you know, hostile environment. The temperatures down there can be extremely cold because the coldest temperature in the solar system, I'm taken to task on this by many people, when you ask the question to groups we talk to, younger and older, what's the coldest place in the solar system? And people go, well, way out there by dwarf Pluto. And I say, no, the South Pole of the moon has had temperatures measured below 400 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's incredible. So we're going to go back. The Japanese are going to go back. It'll hopefully be a place where a manned habitation module, including the Chinese, they probably, in my estimation, will beat us there. And I think this is always the way it is. They're very technologically advanced, and they may be the ones to send humans back to the moon before even the U.S. does it. Stay tuned.
Paulie in Westwood, what's your question for Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky?
Hey, Frank, Dr. Sky. I was wondering, why can't they have, like, a self-leveling kit on the lunar craft when it's landing? Like they have an RV.
Very good question. Yeah, very good question. I have an RV too, and I can tell you that saved me, because the biggest problem, not just to go off on RV, is if you have one of those, you know, flames in there in a refrigerator, and the RV is off angle, sometimes you could start a fire in there, one of the biggest causes of fire. But on the surface of the moon, You're right. I don't know if they have those embedded in those spacecraft. I have no knowledge of that. But obviously, that's more what? Common sense. And hopefully in the future, we have a way to level out these spacecraft. Like I mentioned before, Paulie, this big Starship craft is this big, tall, 165-foot-long sci-fi-looking craft, you know, super high-technology stainless steel. God help us if it comes down straight and all of a sudden with those little teeny-weeny legs, it hits a rock or something. Well, maybe they could get some sort of a hydraulic leveler, but I wouldn't want to see that thing roll over, especially if I was on it. There you go.
Yeah.
Thanks, Paulie. Hey, we are very excited about this eclipse that is now just a matter of weeks away, and we've just added a new station to our ever-growing lineup of stations, this time WATN in Watertown, and a lot of my friends up there, including the former mayor, Jeff Graham, who you could hear every day at noon on that station, he is saying that a lot of people are actually making vacation arrangements to Watertown, specifically because they're going to have such a great view of the eclipse. Where are things with the eclipse at the moment, Steve?
Well, it's exciting. We're like you said, almost a month and a few days, like 32 days away. But what's happening across 13 states in the United States, all the way down from Texas and all the way up into the far portions of Maine and up into Canada, even areas a little bit of Montreal, Canada actually gets it. But talking specifically to that gentleman and the radio station there, welcome aboard, as we would say, but that eclipse will take place for them almost right on center line, Frank. So at 3:25 in the afternoon, Eastern Daylight Time on April 8th, the sun will be 42.2 degrees high in the sky. This is an exact number. You'll get 3 minutes and 37.9 seconds of totality, which is a really impressive thing. And we say hello to all of our military friends right there, what, at Fort Drum, who experienced this also. Let me say this to the New York audience that you have there so proudly. If you drove straight up Interstate 87, here's the interesting thing. Frank, in downtown Manhattan, let's say you're at the World Trade Center, the sun will be eclipsed there, and the moon will cover it, by 91%. Now, that's not 100% by any means, so there's no cigar. You would probably want to drive, if it was me, up the 87, as people know. Go up past Lake George, and if you start to hit areas that are just, well, we're talking a little bit of a distance, Plattsburgh, New York will get a direct hit on this, meaning you're in center line. So if you're just a few miles, and I'm looking at a map right now that we have in front of us that's very detailed, just about 25 miles north of Lake George, you would start to see the totality of maybe 15 seconds. Go another 20 miles, 90 seconds. Go another 40 miles, 2 minutes, 3 minutes as you go about 70 miles. But all the way up in Plattsburgh, you'll get it. But Frank, how about we mix sports with a total eclipse? Listen to this one. In Cleveland, Ohio, the new name of what? The Cleveland, instead of the Cleveland Indians, where they were from 1915 to 1921, it's now what? The Cleveland Guardians. Their home opening game on April 8th, the first ball goes pitched out at 5:10 p.m. against the White Sox. Now, what's so important about that? They're going to open up that stadium in the field at 2 p.m. because the eclipse is going to happen right around the 3 o'clock mark, just before the game. Can you imagine how amazing that would be there? And I would think that eclipse, if it was happening when the fans were in the stadium and it was a clear day, that would be unprecedented. So 3:15 p.m. their time, okay, in Cleveland, Ohio, they get 3 minutes and 52 seconds. Wouldn't that be amazing, Frank, to be at a game like that? Big sports fans. And out standing outside in the parking lot, whether you're out there having, you know, free game barbecue or whatever you can do, that would be amazing. So the whole country is going to get it. We'll be in Texas. We're hoping for clear weather. You know, we're hoping everybody has clear weather. But I'm hoping with your okay that as we count down this on the, you know, Cosmic Conversations, we got a lot to say. And hopefully even in the day part of the show, I mean, the station there, that maybe we can, you know, add some contributions to this because this is a big event for everybody in New York, everybody in Ohio. I mean, Frank, when they had the eclipse last in 2017, August 21st, we were up in Idaho. 24 million people across the nation saw it. That's 8.6% of the population, or, you know, narrowing it down, 1 in 12 people got to see this. So if you miss this one for totality, I'm sorry, everybody else gets a partial eclipse. The next good total eclipse in America would be, and I got to watch it, I'm 68, and here we go with the date, August 12th of 2045, and that eclipse will be best in Fort Lauderdale in Florida. And actually even better over in the Bahamas, Nassau, when 6 minutes and 6 seconds of totality, You cannot get a total solar eclipse that lasts longer than 7 minutes and 32 seconds. So hopefully this one in a couple of weeks, Frank. This is a big deal for a lot of people. The state of New York is having all kinds of celebrations, as they are in all the eclipse paths across America.
Well, no doubt about it. 800-848-9222. Jim is in Yonkers. What's your question, Jim?
Hi, Frank, and thank you. Dr. Sky, sure. I have questions about, like, safety, and obviously, you know, I've heard you mention some places that are good to watch. I live just outside the city, yes. And I don't think I'll be able to travel. My son is very interested, and as a matter of fact, you reached out to my son via this show because I contacted you via email.
Oh,
and I
yes.
want to thank
well,
you.
Thank you. Yes.
For that. We actually got the glasses you sent, but I'm, you know, I'm just curious because I remember growing up in the 70s and there was an eclipse and people were, you know, concerned and they were, everybody was talking about you had to have smoke or welders, helmet type stuff, or you look at a eclipse or shadow. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could just, I don't know, give us some more information because I'm definitely interested in again. 2045 is quite a ways to go.
It sure is. Jim, thank you. No, I appreciate it. I'm glad your son enjoyed that. I know we spoke offline here, off air. But here's some tips for everybody listening. And Jim, you and your son. Those solar glasses are important. So just remember, if you're going to acquire any future ones, make sure that they have the ISO certification on them. And that's so important. Now, here's what I suggest that people do not do. And I get into a little trouble with this one. Some people who work, and I respect the trades when they work as welders, they say, well, I use a welder's glass and I take a look at the sun. Well, I would say this way. There's different grades of that. I'm not an expert as a welder. I certainly don't even know how to weld, whether it's TIG or MIG. I'd love to learn. But I wouldn't recommend using that. So these solar glasses are available up here. Just make sure that the ISO certification is really on there. And that's pretty safe to view the sun as we have. But the thing is, you can also do this. This is the coolest little thing, I think, for everybody. And for parents listening out there, or even those with grandchildren, here's an idea. Take a sheet of paper. If you have a clear sky and you don't have those solar glasses, take a saltine cracker. And the real ones have what, Frank? 13 holes in them. That's what I have.
I didn't
take
know
that. That. Well, some of the fake ones have 16. Take a saltine cracker. And this is interesting, Jim, being serious. Hold the white sheet of paper in your hand. Your back, you know, the sun is behind you. Take that little saltine cracker and hold it over the sheet of paper. And I guarantee you, during the partial phases, you're going to see 13 little crescents. And also look around the trees around buildings. You start to see the amazing little crescents all over the ground. And that's, to me, a safe way to do that. And guess what the kids love, obviously, for the parents listening or grandparents. You can have a little party. You know, what can we say, Frank? You have peanut butter and jelly and have them eat the cracker after they have a little eclipse party. So, Jim, I hope some of those answers are good, but I appreciate you and your son, and thank you for talking to me in the past on this, too.
Absolutely, Jim. 800-848-9222. Steve, one of the things that we have talked about from time to time is the Big Bang, right? Whether it occurred as it is supposed to have occurred. What do we know? What's new in terms of the Big Bang theory? What can you tell us about the Big Bang?
Well, here we go. Maybe we can do this in 3 minutes or less, but here we go. The Big Bang timeline in just a few minutes. In the first quadrillionth of a second, and that sounds insane, we find out that time, meaning light, traveled 100 millionth of a trillionth of a quadrillionth of a meter. Now, that's hard to repeat. What is that in physics time? It's called Planck time. So 10 to the minus 43 seconds was that first little burst of time. In other words, when everything began, the universe had zero volume and infinite density. Then there's something that occurred in the universe, still very controversial. It's called M theory, which goes and relates to string theory. That even in quantum physics now, even super subatomic stuff, some people believe vibrational strings are the things that make the universe do its thing. We'll leave it at that. In 10 to the minus 32 seconds, inflation happened, not the kind that you experience, sadly, if you go to the grocery store or you look at your, you know, bank balances, but cosmic inflation, where the universe literally started to seethe out. It's just amazing what happened, what did happen. And in 5 minutes, particles turn into particles with mass. This sounds almost bizarre, and I know we have a short time for this. But something was detected by these particle, you know, accelerators, something called a Higgs boson. People should look at that. It's one of these particles in nature that actually adds mass to something. So we've identified that. So these theories are becoming more and more, you know, absolute or more concrete. And then four forces in the universe actually formed. What are they? Gravity, the strong and weak nuclear force, and electromagnetism. But guess what? The weakest of those that I just mentioned is gravity, which is hard to believe. And then, in a thousandth of a second, particles formed. And this gets into deep stuff, Frank. They're called quarks, leptons, bosons, that Higgs boson. And something that we believe is in the universe, but we haven't detected it yet, called gravitons. The first stars were theoretically evolving at 100 million years after the Big Bang. And guess what? Galaxies, Frank, about 400 million years ago. The beat goes on. Nobody really understands what was before the Big Bang, or as I call it, the Big Expansion. This is stuff we could talk about for hours. And really, not too many people have a solid answer on.
Yeah, that is for sure. 800-848-9222. Bill is in Huntington. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Okay. There's a nearby star. It's about 15 light years away. It's named 40 Eridani. You know the star?
I know the constellation, but I don't know the specific star. But please continue.
It's about a degree and a half away from Procyon, right? And it's okay. About 4.5 magnitude K star.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it has, so you can find it with your telescope pretty easy, right? Yes. It has two companions. One is a red dwarf and one is a white dwarf.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see both of them with your telescope?
You probably could. You said the magnitude was 4. Is that correct, Bill? 4?
The primary is 4.6, mm-hmm. I think. And okay. The two companions, yes. The white dwarf is 9th magnitude and the red dwarf is 11th. It's an
M4
star.
Yes. And let me explain how you see them.
Together.
First, like,
they're 30. Yeah, they're 30. AU away from each other.
Okay. No, the answer simply is this. If those magnitudes, and let me define that for the audience too, a 4th magnitude star is barely visible in bright cities. Out in the country, you'd see it. In the telescope, you'd see it with no problem, obviously. But the two objects, the companions, the white and red dwarf that you mentioned at those magnitudes up to 11, you could see it, but let's define the type of telescope you would need. Simply something like a 6-inch diameter telescope, meaning the more diameter you have of the mirror or the lens, the more light gathering power. So you would be able to see that. But may I ask you a question? That's intriguing to you because why? Have you tried to do this with an instrument or you want to do this?
No, I'd like to do it, but my telescope is 50 years old. There's no aluminum on it anymore.
Oh, boy. Well, you got to get a new mirror resurfaced. Did you build your own?
Well,
is that what you made? Did you make your own?
No, it's Edmund Scientific.
Oh, boy, you mentioned a good one, Bill. I love that company. And for those listening that knew about Edmund Scientific, we used to go down there on high school trips. And that was the coolest place for kids in school. They had the coolest place. You could walk in and buy all kind of army surplus stuff. And that's a great place, but a great place for telescopes at the time. Amazing.
Thank you, Bill. Well, appreciate it. We'll continue with your calls in a moment. 800-848-9222. In a moment, can a planet be made of diamonds? And are we going to see another phone outage caused not by a software glitch, but by the sun? Those are a few of the questions I'll pose to Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky, as we continue our cosmic conversations straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight. Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
The great Frank Sinatra sounds amazing no matter what he's singing about, especially if he's talking about traveling to the moon, though. My guest is someone that knows all about lunar travel and lunar exploration, Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. You can check out the Dr. Sky Experience at redapplepodcastnetwork.com or just search the Dr. Sky Experience on any podcast app. Steve, can a planet be made of diamonds?
Well, interesting, Frank. Astronomers here in Arizona, the University of Arizona, gets credit for what they think. This is theoretical. There's a star actually called 55 Cancri E. It's in the constellation of Cancer. It's 40 light years away. So what's unique about this star, to answer your question? It's a star that they've identified spectrographically. In other words, they look through the telescope and see the different lines of elements, you know, that are beaming out or absorbed or emitted. And this one is a carbon-rich composition planet. So they put their minds into high gear and they say, you know, this planet seems very unusual compared to others that has different structures like the Earth. So if this particular planet, yes, is made mostly of carbon-rich material, diamonds under this particular material under great pressure, as we know, over the years we get diamonds. So theoretically, you could have a planet. We haven't found it as far officially. We haven't gone there. But could you imagine that? What we consider to be diamonds here on the Earth with such great value, like gold and silver and all the other precious metals, we could wind up finding a common, you know, place you could go there, let's say, and scrape up something, or 5 million carats or something like that. So, yes, it's highly probable, and that's what they think of all the stars they've seen. 55 Cancri E, 40 light years away. It might be a place for gemologists to get on the next starship from SpaceX.
Wow. Igor is in New Jersey. Hello, Igor.
Greetings, Frank. Hi. Greetings, Steve. Steve, thank my you, question for you is about the Malaysian Airlines flight that went awry. There are so many machines, complex machines these days that can be controlled remotely. So many things have abilities to download new software on their own. I would imagine in the wrong hands, they've also said that things like power plants could be taken over, control over. Do you think there's any possibility that somebody, obviously with very bad intentions, took over that plane and operated it remotely through some back door through the software?
Everything's possible. I mean, we talk about this in another, not necessarily off the subject or off the topic, are these things called DEW, directed energy weapons. Now, who knows? I mean, there's all this controversy about, and that's another interesting show to talk about, about directed energy weapons. Well, what caused the fires in Maui? Well, you know, that's a open-ended question. But anyway, Igor, what we're saying here is, yes, anything's possible, but I don't know, with my limited knowledge of computers, I'm not a computer expert, how they would beam such a, you know, thing to sabotage that aircraft. You know, maybe they went on board or somebody went on board ahead of time and just changed the whole software paradigm on that. But then why wouldn't the captain, unless he was complicit in this, take over the controls of the aircraft? Obviously, you could disengage an autopilot if it was going to lock on and follow the bad software. That is very interesting, though, Igor, but I don't know. You and I, Frank, need to think more about that one, I guess.
We do indeed. Thank you very much. Steve, one of the things that occurred last week when all these AT&T customers lost their phone at a very critical part of the day that deals with school drop-off and things like that. A lot of AT&T customers were rightly peeved and not necessarily satiated with the $5 AT&T was giving them. They're claiming, and I have no reason to disbelieve them, that this was due to some sort of a software glitch. Other people said maybe it was a hack. But initially, a lot of us thought that this had something to do with some sort of a solar flare or some sort of a coronal mass ejection. We've talked about this before. What are we looking what do we have on the horizon in terms of solar activity and what effect that may have on electronics, radio signals, things of that nature?
Great concern and great question. A couple of weeks ago, or just about 2 weeks, maybe just into the timeline, active region 3590 blasted off three X-level flares in the course of 24 hours. Now, is that unlikely that there won't be more of these? Of course there will be. Now, this whole outage with cellular, this is interesting too. I don't know, I'm asking you a question now. All I remember is, Frank, did you hear that it was not just AT&T? I read, or some thinks I read this clearly, that it wasn't just AT&T, but other cellular carriers went down.
I did read that, but then those phone carriers came out and said that they believe those outages were due to people trying to reach AT&T customers, and say the Verizon folks or people with other phone companies were trying to call folks with AT&T phones, and that's why they were reporting they have no service.
Okay, now I understand. But going back to the sun and solar cycle 25, it's not reached its peak yet. Not to be alarmist, we're expecting another series of what I consider to be larger than level six that we had. A 6.1, I believe, was the big one, the highest so far of solar cycle 25. So you can expect more. And I believe accurately, on the far side of the sun, they're detecting with spacecraft the imaging of another massive sunspot group about to come on from the left side of the sun. Sun rotates on its equator about once, you know, it rotates 25 days to make a complete circle in its own rotation, 33 days toward the pole. So you can expect more of those. And obviously it's good that that wasn't caused by a solar flare, because we haven't seen one. You know, a level six flare of an X class could do some damage, but you have to have that flare blast off in the CME best when it's right in the center of the disk of the sun. That's like a kill shot. That's a terrible word, but that's what happened in September of 1859 with the Carrington event. A massive sunspot, well, this big giant blob on the sun, caused this incredible surge of energy, causing the Victorian internet, which is telegraph, to set the phone lines and the telegraph lines on fire. Very amazing stuff. And we're due for something, but let's keep our fingers crossed and hope it doesn't wipe us out.
Steve is in Queens. Steve, you're on with Dr. Sky. What's your question?
Yes, Dr. Sky, I have a question for you. The sun, with all these massive flares, two points I want to make very quick. The first one is, if a large space body, like a, say, 400-mile diameter asteroid hit the sun, would it cause fusion reaction like a super bomb? And also, is the sun going to become eventually, at this rate, a C-feed variable star?
Theoretically, no. Let me start with the first part. If an object that size hit the sun would literally eat it alive. And we've seen cometary objects that were 30 and 40 kilometers in diameter, not a trace. You didn't even notice anything happened on the sun. But the interesting part about that is, as we look deeper to the second part of your concern, as you look deeper into the sun, you know, this is an amazing thing that's happening with the sun here. But all I can say is, this whole solar cycle that's just literally getting, you know, high intensity here, we ain't seeing nothing yet. But tell me again, I didn't quite hear and understand the second part, if you could do it quickly. I didn't quite hear that. I'm sorry.
There are stars that are called Cepheid variables.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Class 1, class 2, and such. Would the sun eventually migrate into that category?
Probably not. I mean, it would probably have to be a much larger object to be a Cepheid-type variable. And Cepheid, so the audience knows, are used as kind of like a way to measure distances in the universe. Our sun, being a G-class spectral star, meaning it's an average, you know, of the line of all types of, you know, spectral class stars, will probably do this in about 4 billion years. It will eventually collapse because it's used up all of its hydrogen. It's used up all of its helium. It's starting to use fusion of heavier metals. And then if that implosion takes place, because even a trillionth of a second on this one, Steve, it would then collapse as a star, but not in the category of a Cepheid. It's not necessarily a Cepheid variable at all.
Steve, thank you. Steve, we only have about 40 seconds left here, and one day we're going to have to get you to do 2 hours because there's a ton of questions we didn't get to, but I have to ask you about this. Sunday, we're setting the clocks ahead. You reside in a state that does not observe this barbaric practice known as daylight saving time. Where do you come down on this issue, Steve? Are you for this or against it?
Well, I'm actually against it, and I think there's been legislation to try to get this whole thing changed because it's kind of disruptive to a lot of people. But the biggest misnomer, and I think not in your sense, but a lot of broadcasters call it daylight savings time. It has nothing to do with savings and loan associations or banks. It's simply called daylight saving time. I would be against it, and I'd love to hear what the audience thinks in the future. But Frank, I would suggest they go to the Dr. Sky Experience at WABCRadio.com. Because there's new updates on the eclipse if people want to hear information on the best.
Absolutely. A phenomenal idea. And the rest of us that don't live in Arizona will suffer through daylight saving time and losing an hour of sleep. Ah, we'll see you in 2 weeks, Steve. For the rest of you, keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars.